tuning in. I don't think you actually tune in to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. My name is John McAdam, and this is the only wicked good wrestling podcast out there. It has been a hectic day at STW HQ. And just so everyone knows, we're recording this Wednesday, December the 5th at night. And yeah, the day started off with me learning that Dynamite Kid had passed away, which we'll be discussing, obviously. And then I get word that Sean Goodwin, who is usually in my co-host chair, is sick. The guy's got the flu. And I contacted him, and I'm like, Sean, you know, what's up? Are you okay? And he's like, yeah, I'll try to tank through it. I cough a lot, though. I'm like, Sean, just get better. Don't worry about it. And when something like that happens, you know, you got to remember, when life gives you lemons, you've got to put the lemons in the freezer overnight, then the next morning throw them at life's head. With Dynamite gone, I have the perfect co-host this week to help talk about him, and that is my friend of over 30 years, Jeff Bowdren. Jeff, how you doing? And thank you so much for coming on.
Hold on one second. I got a cough. Okay, I'm better now. So it's a pleasure to join you to discuss not just the career of the DK Dynamite Kid, but all things wrestling, because we're going to stick to wrestling. No top five list on this show, John.
There you go. Actually, have we done top five list? I don't think so. We've done lists. But anyway, Jeff, let me ask you something. You and I think are two lucky guys, because we got in early on the Wrestling Observer thing. We're like, you know, two of the 80s guys, as it goes. When did you first start watching, obtaining Japanese wrestling?
I want to say it was late summer, early fall of 1986, when I got the dreaded Meltzer tape list.
Yes.
And then I made my first copious purchase that I'm sure Dave listed on his income tax that year, and picked up, I want to say like five Japanese tapes, and my life changed forever.
I mean, you were even more into it than I was. And I, back in the 80s, I loved New Japan. I loved All Japan, too, but New Japan really stuck out.
Yeah, no, there's no question. You know, seeing guys like Dynamite and Davey Boy against George Takano, the Cobra, and Kuniaki Kobayashi, guys like that was really just life-altering stuff for me as a wrestling fan, at least.
Oh, I can take that a step further, and I will. But anyway, what was the first Dynamite Kid match you ever saw?
In retrospect, I'm sure I probably watched the match with him and Sayama from Madison Square Garden, because, of course, all those shows were on USA. I'm trying to think, though, as far, you know, obviously I didn't see any of his stuff in Japan until after, you know, I'd gotten Dave's tapes. And those matches were a couple years old. It wasn't until down the road that I had access to his stuff from Calgary and Portland as well. But the stuff that I was watching from Japan, of course, was a couple years old, because, you know, truthfully, by the fall of 86, he had started working more full time in the WWF. And even though he was making the occasional trip, he had switched to All Japan by that point. Mm-hmm. for the money grab. But nothing's wrong with that. But all his great, great stuff was really, I thought, in New Japan. He had some good matches in All Japan, but the really great stuff was in New Japan.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the first the first match I saw it on USA Network, either the very beginning of 83 or the very end of 82. They had an MSG show from had to be beginning of 83, from December 1982. And, you know, the words, terms like blown away and awesome are just, they get kind of overused, but not this time, man. This match to me was absolutely incredible. It blew my mind.
Well, you know, one of the things we've talked about, the Dynamite, Barry Rose and I have talked about it on my own podcast. And, you know, I've always said that I felt Dynamite was a generational wrestler. And by that, what I mean is I felt that Dynamite, I mean, let's be honest, if you look at it, think about how many guys over the last 30 years had their style directly or indirectly influenced by Tom Billington. You know, we could sit here and we could probably talk for about 2 hours on the dark side of Tom Billington, because good Lord, there was that. But in the ring, he was a guy whose influence is still being felt to this day. When you watch Kushida, when you watch, you know, Kenny Omega, you know, and other guys, you know, who are smaller, some of the guys that wrestle in NXT are doing, you know, stuff that, Tyler Bate, I watched him at a match recently. There's a lot of the Dynamite Kid and Tyler Bate, you know. So, I mean, that just shows all the way up to the most recent talent that's being featured in NXT are still using, you know, stuff that was first stamped on the mat by Dynamite Kid, Tom Billington.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and you look at his style, it wasn't just a high-flying, like, Mexican style or even a Sayama style. I mean, what he, the stuff he did to his body was absolutely brutal. Some of the bumps he took in order to punish his opponent.
Well, you know, and that's just it. He, you know, Sayama was doing the unbelievable aerial stuff, but Tom Billington wrestled, he wrestled violent, and he really was wrestling almost like a hard style that like Brody and Hanson were working in All Japan. Tom Billington was using that on the junior heavyweights in New Japan. And, you know, he was a guy that went in there and you know, you earned your paycheck when you work with Tom Billington, because he was going to, you know, he was going to go in there and he was going to work stiff. He was going to work hard, but he was going to get a great match out of you. And, you know, the stories that I've always heard about Dynamite is that, you know, when he was working Calgary, it wasn't that, you know, when he was working in the Calgary shows, you know, the TV tapes and whatever, that he would do the big bumps. That was stuff that they accepted was part of his style. What really concerned the guys that worked in Calgary, you know, in the Hart family, was that Tom Billington was taking those bumps when he would go up and work spot shows in Medicine Hat. I mean, he was doing dives off the top rope onto the floor, doing like a knee drop. In front of like 150 people in Medicine Hat. That's the crazy stuff. You know, it's one thing to do that on a huge show or a huge pay-per-view where you're getting paid a huge amount, you got a huge audience, but you're doing it in front of 150 people and you're making $50. That's kind of insane.
Yeah, especially if, you know, I can see a guy if he's first starting out and that's all he's doing. You know, you do the crazy bumps in front of 150 people and that's just the way it is. But I mean, if you're reasonably established and you're working a territory like Calgary and you've got big shows and small shows, yeah, you've got to save that stuff for the big shows, man.
Oh no, absolutely. You need to, pick your spots. Just like in a marital argument, you need to pick your spots. Well, when you're in wrestling, you got to pick your spots and do your spots on the big shows, you know, which isn't to say that you shouldn't give those 150 fans in Medicine Hat, you know, their money's worth. You absolutely should. But you also need to measure out, you know, if you're going to do an insane move or something that you've been, you know, in your own mind, working out in your own mind that, hey, I want to try this spot. And, you know, maybe that's what it is. But, geez, you know, don't do something that's going to, you know, a week or 2 weeks later, you're still going to be paying for. Save that for the big shows, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not really familiar with how many shows per week they ran in Calgary. I'm going to guess 5 or 6 because that's pretty much what everyone did. And if you're doing that to yourself 5 or 6 days a week, I mean, it's going to show up.
It's going to take its toll. And then as he moved on to the WWF, I mean, obviously he was getting, dare I say, some chemical enhancement. And the
one else I've ever seen before.
Yeah, I mean, the injuries began to take their toll.
Yeah, I mean, he was 5'8", just a miniature mountain of muscle when he was in the WWF. I mean, he was so blown up. What can I say?
No, and you know, one of the things I was reading Greg Oliver's very well-done obituary today, and he was saying that Dynamite was probably a guy that was naturally about 160 pounds, and when he went to the WWF, at his height there as part of the British Bulldogs, he was probably 195, 200 pounds. So he had put on essentially 35 to 40 pounds of added muscle that was not, dare I say, natural muscle. And, you know, all of a sudden, maybe those injuries are having some problems healing and responding to what he's putting his body through. And that's what led ultimately. And, this, you know, I'm not just blaming the WWF. It's the stuff he did in Calgary and Portland and in Japan. And that's why he ended up and spent like the majority of the last 10 or 15 years in a wheelchair, for God's sakes.
Yeah, and I believe I heard the wheelchair story for the first time back in like 99 or 2000, which, and you know what? You don't mean to sound callous, but I couldn't say I was surprised.
No, and you know, I was reading something on my own message board today where someone said, you know, I think it was our mutual friend Ron Lemieux. He said, you know, maybe some people would say this is a case of karma that has been long overdue. You know, the fact, I'm not talking about him dying. I'm talking about the fact that he was in a wheelchair, but you know, You know, that's not for me to decide and for me to judge. That's someone, like I said before on my show, that is getting a higher pay grade than that's going to decide whether or not it's karma and poetic justice, as they would say, for what the Dynamite Kid is going through. Because, you know, as I said, there was certainly a dark side to Tom Billington that, you know, perhaps we will discuss here, that I think when you look at his legacy, you have to equate the positive side of Tom Billington, who was a person that young wrestlers aspire to be like, also with the other side of Tom Billington, who was the person that was a nightmare for promoters to deal with in the locker room, outside the locker room, and was by all accounts really not a nice person. And that's being very generous in putting it that way.
You know, I pointed out, well, first of all, let's talk about the chemical enhancement. I mean, everyone in the WWF, not literally everyone, but I would say 95% of the guys were using. The guys who weren't using were guys like Dusty Rhodes, One Man Gang. That's about it. I mean, let's just be honest about that.
Well, and then you had, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to say you had guys like Don Morocco, who were not small guys, who were big guys to begin with, who had built themselves up, but now they were just getting freakishly large. There used to be jokes about how it appeared Morocco's head had shrunk because his back and his shoulders were so large through the enhancement. And that was just one example. As you said, you know, 90% of the guys, you know, pretty much, I think if they had had to drop a urine right there, they would have tested positive for something. I mean, and that's just to say nothing of the schedule where one night they're, you know, I have no idea what sort of sadist dreamt up their travel schedule, where they're literally working in Los Angeles, then Boston, then they're going back to Seattle. So the guys are operating where they're not sleeping, you know, they're doing everything they can to keep their body looking in shape for television, dare I say, or pay-per-view. And so, you know, you have trouble falling asleep, so you take something to fall asleep. You get up in the morning, you have trouble staying awake, so you know, take something to get awake. You have to go out and get yourself ready for the match. And, you know, it's just an insane – these guys are working over 300 days a year doing that, traveling to and from across the country, didn't spend any time with their family. It was just absolute insanity.
The WWF schedule back in the 80s looked like this. The wrestlers supposedly, or were supposed to, get every other Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday off. So that is an 11-day stretch on the road, and the WWF would book them on the earliest flight possible. So they would be up before 6 o'clock, getting to the airport, because the WWF figured, well, A, those are the cheaper flights, and B, if something goes wrong, you've got all day to figure out how to get to the next city one way or the other. And yeah, you had guys literally collapsing at airports at one point.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, you really understand why there was a need. You know, it's not justifying it, but, you know, the guys that would start getting into the cycle, not just of steroids, but like uppers and downers and, you know, of course, cocaine in the mid 80s, I don't have to tell you, was just a little bit prevalent for those that had the financial resources. And, you know, then you'd be up from the cocaine and need to bring yourself down, whether it was with alcohol or some other sort of chemical substance. And, you know, needless to say, it made your sleep cycles completely chaotic.
Sure. I mean, these guys are on the road. You know, I've had wrestlers tell me they wake up, they're like, what city am I in? And you know, you're on the road, and what do you do when you're on the road with nothing to do? You party.
Yeah, of course. And certainly you have the party that's available for you there in the hotel lobby or in the hotel bar. You've got the marks and the rats that are there who want to meet their, you know, celebrity wrestling for, you know, people. And so they make themselves available either through, passing on some chemical enhancement, maybe passing on some sexual advances. You know, that's the rock star lifestyle, and it was especially prevalent during that period of the 80s.
Yeah, and like you said, it wasn't just wrestling. It wasn't just music. I mean, this went on in the NBA, the NFL, baseball had been going on for decades.
Sure, yeah, but the travel schedule, even for like an NBA player or a Major League Baseball player or a professional athlete, just the fact that excuse me, nowadays, if you sit there and think about the WWE travel schedule, you know, if they're going to work a show in Miami, probably the next night they're going to be in Tampa and then Orlando and then Jacksonville. Yeah, it's going to be some sort of like symmetry you can do that, as opposed to being in Boston one night. They put you in L.A. or San Francisco the next. Then they want you to fly to Atlanta or to maybe Miami, and you're going cross country. And like you correctly pointed out, you wake up and you're like, what city am I in and what day is this?
Yeah, and don't forget that on Saturday and Sundays, they always had double shots. So you're traveling not only in the morning, you've got an afternoon flight as well.
Yeah, and if, God forbid, the weather is bad, or if it's the middle of winter, that's just too bad. They still expect you to be there, and that's why they book you on those early flights, which just makes for a complete, you know, personal nightmare, you know, of a lifestyle. And that's why so many of the guys got hooked on the enhancement, you know, whether it be, you know, the steroids or later on the HGH or something like that. But obviously it was in full bloom then. And Tom Billington took full advantage of it, knowing that potentially his job, you know, counted on him looking the way he did. Because let's be honest, Vince McMahon is not going to push a guy that weighs 160 pounds, no matter how good he is. You know, Dynamite Kid at 200 pounds, the British Bulldogs, you know, him and Davey Boy. And Davey Boy, who was, you know, had a much bigger frame than Dynamite, what still wasn't a big framed guy in the manner of, you know, like you said, your one man gangs or something like that. But he had started physically enhancing himself, too. But he didn't look like a pincushion the way that Dynamite did.
Exactly. You know, before I forget this, I'm going to throw this out there. I want to welcome Lou Kippelman to Stick to Wrestling. He is our producer behind the board today, and thank you for all you do, Lou. Secondly, before I forget, we have a Facebook board, Stick to Wrestling. If you enjoy the show, I think you're going to enjoy the board. Check it out. I'll be happy to approve you. But anyway, you can't talk about Dynamite without talking about the book. And I was saying earlier today that, look, a lot of the guys in the wrestling business were no worse than Dynamite Kid, or at least on his level. And, you know, but the difference is that Dynamite Kid wrote a book about it. And I think that's why he gets vilified and some other people do not. But it's also fair to point out that, well, he wrote the book, and you get what comes with that.
Well, and it allows you to get Dynamite's version of what happened. You know, I mean, let's be honest, to the people, you know, wrestling history is now in the minds of the casual fan has, you know, been rewritten by Vince McMahon and the guys in the WWE front office. Because, you know, if it wasn't for wrestling historians like, you know, yourself or guys like Scott Teal or Brian Last or Dave Meltzer, you know, the story wouldn't be getting out there, because, you know, Vince McMahon has made an attempt to whitewash wrestling history. You know, nobody went to wrestling in the 70s until Vince McMahon took it national. You know, that's the way they want to spin it for you. But, you know, so Dynamite puts out his version of the story as he sees it before it gets a chance to have someone else's. I'm not going to say whitewash, but instead of someone else putting out their version of what happened or their side of the story, Dynamite gets his side of the story out there first.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So let's talk a little bit about how his career went. There's a story out there that Bill Watts was ready to hire Dynamite Kid and Davey Boy Smith. Were they called the British Bulldogs in Japan, or did the WWF come up with that?
No, that was strictly a WWE thing. I you know, the story's always been told. You know, I think I first heard it from Dave Meltzer, that Dave was sending videotapes from Japan to Joel Watts, and Joel had been watching the stuff from New Japan with Dynamite and Davey Boy, which of course were just off the chart matches, and they were doing incredible tag team maneuvers like nothing that was even being seen. I mean, even stuff that was past like Ricky and Robert. And of course, they decided that they would like to bring them in and have them face off with either Ricky or, you know, I thought originally it was going to be having them come in as baby faces and face the Midnight Express. But I think actually what they were thinking about was bringing them into Mid-South, sending Jimmy and the boys to Dallas, and then bring in Dynamite and Davey Boy and have them work a program with Ricky and Robert, which I think would have been incredible. But as I've also said on my show, and I think I might have said it to you the time that you were a co-host on my show, you know, thinking about Tom Billington in a locker room having to deal with some of Bill Watts's restrictions, I think would have been pretty humorous, actually.
That would have been pretty crazy. I mean, Billington, you know, these are two hard-headed guys, and only one of them is the boss.
Yeah, and, you know, I think any records that Buddy Landell might have set for having the most fines taken out of his paycheck that year might have been topped by Tom Billington. You know, and let's go ahead and just kind of deal with the elephant in the room, John, if you don't mind. You know, Tom Billington was an unbelievable talent in the ring. And like I said before, don't want to rehash, he was a guy that influenced so many people's career. But let's talk about the elephant in the room, the fact that Tom Billington was really kind of an asshole. And that's a polite way of saying it. He was a real headache in the locker room. He was a ribber extraordinaire, but in a very cruel, calculated, and mean-spirited way.
Yeah, that is exactly what I heard. I used to know one of the WWF guys who got along with Dynamite Kid. And his version of it was that if Dynamite liked you, you were fine. But if for whatever reason he picks something out and he doesn't like you, he really could make your life hell, like an everyday thing or multiple times per day where you're dealing with him.
Yeah, and I know at least, you know, the Rougeaus very famously had an issue with Dynamite. And then they sought their own form of retribution in the form of the Rougeaus, I believe, jumping Dynamite in the locker room with a roll of coins in their hand. And I think they knocked out a couple of Dynamite's teeth. And, you know, because things had gotten so tense and so hectic in the locker room. And, you know, a lot of times when you're dealing with a wrestling locker room, there's a thought process of boys will be boys. And instead of nipping a problem in the bud, like, you know, Vince McMahon probably should have done at the time, he let it fester and fester and fester, and it just exploded in his locker room.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, he could, you know, he was relentless from what I've heard if he decided he didn't like you. I mean, you read his book, right?
Yes. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I read it years ago. I haven't read it recently, reread it. I had the book, and I, of course, made the mistake of lending it to someone who did not give it back to me.
I haven't read the book in like 8 or 9 years. But I remember this was after he was in the WWF. There was some wrestler from North Carolina who liked to talk about being from North Carolina, and that was it. That was the thing that drove him over the edge, and once again, he's making this guy's life miserable over that.
Well, you know, who knows what it is that sets somebody off, you know? Or he just doesn't like the look of your face. Maybe he doesn't like the fact you talk about you're from North Carolina. You know, one of the stories that I have told before is that my friend Tom Nash was one of the Blackhearts who went up to Calgary. He went up there when Dynamite had just been made the booker. And he was a guy that the Dynamite had dropped one night in a bar, had dropped a Mickey in his drink and threw him out naked outside the bar. And we're talking about the middle of winter in Calgary. They, you know, then they thought that was a hilarious rib to play on somebody. You know, this was a guy that he wasn't doing stuff. You know, you hear the stories about on, you know, road trips, where they would all get together in that famous, you know, Calgary van, and all the guys would travel to the spot shows, you know, when it was like, you know, minus 15 degrees outside, and they're driving on these two-lane country roads in the middle of bum F Egypt. And it's just like, it creates insanity, because if a guy falls asleep, they're going to get preyed upon by Dynamite. He's going to shave the eyebrows, do whatever. And, you know, considerably, that's really the minor stuff, is just getting your eyebrows shaved. The really malicious stuff is taking a dump in your, you know, your gear bag, you know, and things like that were just daily occurrences on the road with Dynamite.
I mean, Mick Foley told the story in his book when he was just breaking into the wrestling business. He was a kid just out of wrestling school in Pittsburgh, and the WWF did a taping, and he was on the taping just as an enhancement talent. And he goes up to the British Bulldogs in the locker room, says, "Hi, I'm a big fan of you guys from Japan." And they decided to brutalize him in the ring over it.
Yeah, see, just, you don't know what's going to set him off. And, you know, you really wonder, has Davey Boy been given a pass on all this? Because he's really kind of a willing participant in this. But, you know, when the people talk about this, the mean-spirited stuff that the British Bulldogs did, you never hear them saying, well, it was Davey Boy that did it. You know, most of it is it's all Tom Billington, and Davey Boy's just going along with it. And, you know, I don't know if that's the case or not. I mean, I'm not sitting there trying to stamp on the grave of Davey Boy Smith, you know, but I'm just saying it seems like he's getting an awful lot of free passes for stuff that they were both doing, you know. And whether or not it was all Billington and really Davey Boy had nothing to do with it, well, then I apologize to the memory of Davey Boy Smith. But it just seems like, you know, from a brief look at it, like Davey Boy gets a free pass on a lot of this.
That's exactly what I was saying earlier today, that, you know, I've heard stories about Davey Boy that, like, I'm not even going to repeat on this podcast, not even for fear of litigation. Just, you know, they're that awful. And you're right. I mean, but again, the difference was, you know, Davey didn't write a book about it, bragging about it, and Dynamite did.
No, and that's true. So let me ask you, John, what, when you remember, you know, you talk about that match from Madison Square Garden, let me just throw this out there. You got a top three Dynamite Kid match, but and not even talking about the tag team, just Dynamite himself.
Oh, what are my top three Dynamite matches?
Yeah, top three Dynamite matches. I'm sorry.
Okay, you know what? I'm not going to know the dates on these, but they were two spectacular matches that he had against Tiger Mask. This isn't going to be helpful. One, he had a full head of hair, and the other time his head was shaved.
Yeah, I'm sure one of them was the match from, I want to say, April of 1983. That was one of the ones I think that might have been my number two match of the decade. That's the one with the broken bottle.
Okay.
You recall that one where he broke the bottle at ringside and was threatening Sayama with the broken bottle?
I don't remember that one. That's insane.
Yeah,
I've probably seen it.
Because their matches are definitely out there, whether it's on YouTube or New Japan World, and the whole series of matches between Sayama and Dynamite Kid. If anyone hasn't seen them, that's listening to this show, which quite frankly would amaze me. But if you haven't, please go out of your way to watch those matches. They're absolutely crazy. April of 1983, I'm just guessing right off the top of my head, the match from Madison Square Garden, and there's others, but those are the two that stand out to me. Personally, he also had some great matches with other guys, with Tatsumi Fujinami while he was here. And then, of course, all the stuff from Calgary. And, I don't want to leave out the stuff from Portland. He had a great match with Buddy Rose. And did you ever see the match where he broke Kurt Hennig's neck?
No.
Yes, in Portland. He does a spot. And I don't know if he's doing a tombstone pile driver or something like that, but he legit broke Kurt Hennig's neck in the middle of a match, and they had to go to the finish. But that was kind of crazy. But yeah, he had a great run in Portland. I want to say
late 83, early 84.
Yeah, I was going to say I thought it was 83. I wasn't sure exactly when the specifics were, but I knew it was 83. But left quite a legacy there.
Yeah, I have an anecdote about a Tiger Mask match, and this goes back. Well, you and I were on one of the 605 Star Wars specials maybe about a year and a half ago, and Brian asked us, he's like, do you guys, has pro wrestling ever interfered in, like, your relationships? And it was funny because the other guys, I think, were like trying to come up with one. And I could come up with like a 4-hour series of how I have messed things up or just complicated things with my love of wrestling. But I'll try to make this long story short. 87, my girlfriend Jennifer, we're both 21 years old. We had crushes on each other when we were teenagers, but it never got off the launching pad. Then one day, after not seeing her for like 3-4 years, I bump into her and boom, we're getting serious right away, right? Well, right around this time is when I started getting the Observer, and I start getting the tapes, and I enter into that whole cult. You know how it is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I get my first Japan tape, and it has Sayama versus Dynamite Kid on it. And instead of like being nice to my girlfriend on a date, we're watching wrestling at my place. And it's a Dynamite Kid versus Sayama match. And Dynamite Kid is in a heated argument with the referee. And the girl, who was not familiar with wrestling, is like, oh, my God, he's arguing with the referee. What a jerk. And as soon as the word jerk comes out of his mouth, he headbutts the referee right in his face. And the look of disbelief on this girl's face was incredible. That's my favorite Dynamite Kid moment.
Well, I think, as I've said on my show before, I'm on my third marriage, and my love for professional wrestling in general played a part in the lack of success, I'll say, in the first two marriages. My first wife, I'll tell you a story. This has nothing to do with Tom Billington, but I was up watching World Class, and this is about 1984, 85. And we had just been married a few months, and, I was up watching World Class, which was being shown out here at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And it was the skit where Bill Mercer went to see Scott Casey. They were doing a program with Scott Casey, and I forget it. I don't know if it was Chris Adams or something like that. And Scott Casey had Sunshine with her as he was, it wasn't really his valet, but she was kind of accompanying Scott Casey. And so Bill Mercer goes to talk to Scott Casey, knocks on the door. You know, there are the 1,000 vignettes at World Class where Bill Mercer went to visit somebody. And he opens the door, And Sunshine answers the door, and she's like wearing like this real kind of slinky little robe, you know, and she's like, oh, hi, Bill. How you doing? And so Bill kind of like does like one of these things where he turns and looks at the camera. Oh, well, we're here to see Scott Casey. And so I just audibly, I thought it was so funny. I went, oh, you little hussy, you. And my wife is lying there next to me. She's like, excuse me? What did you? She thought I was talking to her. And I was talking to Sunshine. And then let's see, the second wife. Well, the second wife was after I really got into the Japanese tapes. So I was probably spending a little more time watching Japanese wrestling than I should have. And since we're on your show, John, can we now tell the story about how John McAdam had an impact on my wedding day? Do you recall
that? Oh, yeah, definitely.
I had made the unfortunate decision to have someone tape some football games on the day of my wedding. And I had made a promise to my my second wife that I will not tape any football games on the day of my wedding. And of course I had on the sly contacted John and said, okay, here are the games I need to, you to hook me up with. You got your Florida State, Michigan, Notre Dame, Purdue. And there's probably a Tennessee game in there because John's a Tennessee guy. But, so he sent them out to me on the sly. My wife did not know about it until about, 3-4 years later. My wife is looking for something to tape General Hospital over. And she pops one of those tapes in and she sees the date that John had helpfully wrote on the outside of the tape. And she says, what's this? What this is the day we got married. And oh, it was not a good day for Mr. Baldwin. So thanks for that, Johnny.
I don't understand. I mean, you lived up to your word. You did not record any football on your wedding day.
I did not. I had someone.
There you go.
That should be my out. It's the Dennis Rodman theory. Are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? Exactly. But
think about this. I once had a friend, this is going back like 20 years. He had Boston Celtics season tickets and he would go watch the games in Boston and he would record them and he would watch them like the next day or something. And this drove his wife nuts. And I remember I was married at the time and my wife was like, there are far worse hobbies for him to have. Relax. And she was right.
Yeah. No, and, you know, my second wife, I have told the story before, she used to actually root against my teams because she felt like those teams had become more important to me than she was, which was not true. But, like, you know, so if Notre Dame or the Vikings were playing, she would be in the bedroom watching the game, rooting against my teams. And I would say, how does that make sense to you? You know I'm going to be unhappy if these teams lose. And, you know, it was just crazy. That's why I'm on my third marriage.
It's not like you're going to stop watching them if they lose, right?
Yeah, no, I know.
Nah, what a bizarre world we all live in. You've got some good stories, though. I got to tell you, I thought I was like the only one with like all kinds of crazy girl stories. But no, but anyway.
Happy I'm on my third marriage and my third wife puts up with me and my love of sports and wrestling.
That is definitely good. You guys have been together for a while now, right?
We are, let's see, now you're going to put me on the spot.
I was hoping you'd know this.
15, we're married 15 together for 19, so.
All right, well,
all I wanted before I met this one was just get into double figures. You know, my parents have been married 67 years, John, and, you know, somehow I'm on my third marriage. I always say that the chromosome split somewhere there, you know, that my parents can stay together for 67 years. I still got them both with me, and that, you know, that I managed to somehow go through three marriages. Who knows?
It's just that back then, and I get this, people just didn't get divorced. That was like a 70s thing that got hot like 40 years ago, and it still remains with us today.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let me ask you this. How did you first start like getting the Observer? Like, how did this come into your life?
Well, I went to the first Crockett Cup at the New Orleans Superdome. I want to say that was like the end of March 1986 or thereabouts.
April 86, yeah.
Yeah, and I went up there with my sister. And my sister, I had just separated from my first wife. My sister was separated from her husband. It seems to be a pattern in the family there. And we decided I wanted to go up to New Orleans to see this show, and my sister wanted to go on a vacation. So she followed, you know, she came up there with me. She figures, oh, we're going to go out and have some fun in New Orleans. And we happened to sit in front of two guys from Jackson, Mississippi, my friends Jeff and David Steele. Jeff, recent guest on the 605 podcast. And we sat there and we started just, you know, kind of chit chat about the matches. I heard them talking, hey, this guy's really good, or, you know, this should be a good match. And so we just, you know, sitting in front of, sitting behind somebody, you sit there and you kind of start shooting the breeze with them. And so they asked me, where are you from? And I said, I was from Florida. And they said, wow, you came up here for this. And we started chit chatting and talking about, you know, stuff. And so we had made an agreement to, that, you know, we exchange addresses, and the guy said, you know, Jeff says, well, you send me the Florida stuff and, you know, tape like 3 or 4 shows, and then I'll send you the UWF show. And I'm like, well, I am in, because I had no access to Mid-South or UWF. And so we swapped packages, and I sent Jeff what was the Dying Days of CWF. As a matter of fact, I always joke that after I sent him the first tape, he said, yeah, I'll keep sending you the show. You don't need to send me anymore. They got their first look at Kendall Windham as the lead babyface in Florida. And what happened was that in his first package of UWF shows, he included this newsletter that he had just started getting. And that, of course, was the Wrestling Observer. I don't know if he met Dave at the Superdome or he had heard about Dave, but he had gotten the Observer about a month or two before. So he had a couple issues, and he sent them in to me, or he passed them along to me. And I read this, and it was just like, oh, my God, what is this? And, you know, honestly, I'd been a wrestling fan for about 13, 14, maybe 15 years. And it's like one of those things where you kind of know something's going on. You know, you figure out you're going to the matches at West Palm Beach and you don't see any cameras, but there's a world title match. And you know the world title's not changing hands there, you know. Or if you're going to a smaller show, it's like, this is too small a venue for the title to change hands. You figured out that if the title's going to change hand, their cameras are going to be there, or it's going to be in a bigger venue where there's like some, you know, some sort of, what sort I'm looking for? Not press there, but, you know, there's going to be something to let you know that something was going to happen, you know, or it was a card that was built up, you know. Like I went to the Night of the Mask in Miami Beach when Dusty was the Midnight Rider, and, you know, they had built that card up to such an extent. Yeah, I could see a title changing hand. Of course, they did the big switcheroo in the back. But, you know, so
you got
so
to see that.
What's that?
You were there for that. Wow.
I was there when Roddy Piper came down and wrestled on a Florida card. And because Roddy Piper was such a huge, big deal on Georgia wrestling then. So naturally, who do they put Roddy Piper in the ring with to, you know, really take advantage of his, you know, celebrity stature on TBS? Chick Donovan. Under the hood.
Oh, I was going to guess Charlie Cook.
Under the hood is Mr. New York. Oh, what a horrible horrible thing was. But so I started getting the Observer. You know, like I said, I'd seen like the Wrestling Eye, those kind of magazines, and even like the stuff like the Ring and the Wrestling Review. They really wouldn't expose the business, but you'd sit there and you start saying, "Whoa, wait a minute, this guy's got a broken leg in Florida," and all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, they say he's wrestling in you know, the Carolinas or in Southeast. So you kind of figured out something was, or you'd see the Japan. You know, whoa, wait a minute, that guy's in Japan. He just got, you know, so you figure stuff out. And then I got the Observer, and I started talking to Jeff on the phone. And Jeff, as he mentioned on the 605, had worked for the, I don't know if it was the Curtis family or the Culkin family down in Mississippi for the promotion down there. And so I started seeing these terms. I'm like, you know, what's a shoot? What's blading? So I'd call Jeff up, and he smartened me up to the, you know, certain terms that I didn't know what they meant, you know. And, you know, I always say, John, I don't know if you felt this way, but, you know, when we would go on these pay-per-view runs and we go to Baltimore or wherever, you know, I always feel like when I was first really getting exposed to the inner workings of the business, the best thing to do sometimes when you're around somebody like Meltzer, or you know, have your first time, you're sitting with somebody that's in the business like Cornette or something, keep your mouth shut and just listen, you know, because you learn so much more than if you open your mouth and you say something stupid. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's what you believe, but I've always, you know, when I have friends, you know, that I would bring to the matches, and I would sit there and say, okay, we're going to go out with this guy, just keep your mouth shut and just listen. You'll learn so much more that way.
Oh, definitely. Were you at Halloween Havoc 89?
The plastic bag angle? No, I was not at that. I, of course, was with you at the Bash in Baltimore in the summer of that year. And, you know, and by the way, I don't know if you ever talked about this on your show. I don't think I've talked about it. How much of a letdown to the great 1989 series. We had Steamboat and Flair, Steamboat and Funk, Muda and Sting. And they give us that stupid tournament. Was it Future Shock? Starcade 89, was that what it was? You know, it was just like the lamest Starcade ever at that point. And, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, they could do a like a loser must retire. Bring back Funk and Flair for one more match. Have it do like a loser retires or something like that. Or maybe hold off the I Quit until Starcade. I just felt like that was such a letdown for Starcade 89.
I am like the one person who actually liked it. However, they had the New York Knockouts clash like maybe 3 or 4 weeks before Starrcade 89.
Which was tremendous.
I always felt that that they should have flip-flopped those, that the tournament should have been on the Clash of the Champions, and Starrcade should have been the blow-off for Flair versus Funk.
And that would have made complete sense. And also, you're holding – I mean, let's be honest. What was it in Troy, New York? And you know, I mean, no offense to Troy, New York, but that's not exactly a hot happening market. Whereas if you put Flair and Funk, you know, like I Quit in Atlanta, I think you're going to get a little local interest there, you know? And I think it would have been better served putting that in, you know, there. I just, that whole tournament thing, I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't remember if it was a great show or not. I don't think there was anything super stellar on that card, but it just wasn't something that I look back on. The way that I do the Bash from Baltimore that year, I still remember how great that card was because there was so much happening. But comparatively speaking, Starrcade, let's be honest, that was their WrestleMania. That was their show that should have been, like you said, the huge blow-off show for the entire year. And they just, it just seemed like they kind of they went out with a whimper instead of a bang at the end of the year.
I agree with you 100%. Do you remember, I know you remember, we went to Baltimore for the Great American Bash. It was an afternoon show, like 4 o'clock. The night before this show, they had a Dynamite show in Philadelphia, which both Jeff and I attended.
Absolutely. They had, and I tell you, the best match of that night, you remember what it was?
I totally remember what it was. It was Lex Luger having a five-star match.
Yeah, it was the best match of Lex Luger's life. Absolutely.
And by this point, Lex really, truly, I'm not saying he's Ric Flair, I'm not saying he's Rick Steamboat, but for this part of his career, he was actually holding up his end of the log.
Well, you know, when you're working as a young guy who, let's be honest, has athletic ability, and you're in the ring with somebody like Ricky Steamboat, you really can't help but look good. You know, I mean, as I had written in the past, you know, at that point, let's take a look at Luger's career from 88 into early 90. He had Flair, he had Steamboat, he had Pillman, then back with Flair. He was working with guys that were really good workers, you know. I mean, he had Hansen. He wasn't working with a bunch of stiffs. And, you know, I think at that point, Luger had, we thought, had kind of turned the corner. All this publicity had been given, all the, you know, to use Luger's own words, the allocades, is that what he said? Remember that? And, you know, but he'd finally turned the corner, and this is going to be a guy that you could maybe look to build your company around, you know, with him and Sting. That's what they had decided to do. And then sometime right after Wrestle War 90, it just seemed like it kind of fell off the cliff, whatever he had been showing there. And then, you know, of course, all the problems with Flair and Jim Herd, you know, which are, you know, well-known and have been talked about a zillion times. But, you know, what I thought Lex Luger was going to become is not what Lex Luger ended up becoming.
I agree with that. I think what happened with Luger, and this is just my theory, is he started to learn how to work. He started to learn how to do things. And then sometime, I want to say early 90, maybe mid 90, he stopped caring. Like, this was just a paycheck to him. He had become disillusioned. And, you know, this was just a job he showed up for. And that was it.
Well, no. And you know, honestly, one of my early complaints watching Lex Luger in Florida was he was essentially, because they really had nobody else. Like I said, they had Kendall Windham, for God's sake, excuse me. And so they took Lex Luger when they made him a babyface in Florida, and I got to suffer through all those early days of Lex Luger when he was really not ready at all. He was just a guy that was built like a Greek god, had a mullet for the ages, and had a great look. But, you know, the complaint that I've always had is, you know, nobody has ever done great business being the second version of somebody. And let's be honest, CWF was trying to build Lex Luger into their Hulk Hogan. Well, what they needed to be doing was create something completely different and get that over, because no one was going to care about the second Hulk Hogan. You know, that's why, you know, the Rock and Roll tag teams, the second tag team was in there. You know, the Fantastics followed up the Rock and Roll in WCW, and the Fantastics were a really, really great tag team, but they were always coming off as the guys that followed Ricky and Robert. That's why they got over so good in World Class, because Ricky and Robert had never been in World Class, you know? That's just my own personal philosophy. And so I think Lex Luger was trying to be made into the second coming of Lex Luger instead of being turned into the first Lex Luger, you know? And you're right. he gave this attitude of this vibe of not giving a crap. He didn't really care if he got better. Now, whether that's the truth or not, that's the vibe he got off, you know, to people. He seemed like he wasn't interested. He was a football player and he was having to lower himself to, you know, do this pro wrestling stuff. And you know what I really think in retrospect that Lex Luger didn't get a chance to do? Lex Luger didn't get to carry around the ring and put up the ring with the ring crew like the guys did back in the day. You know, guys like Barry Windham put up the ring crew or, you know, drove with the ring crew and had the ribs played on him. You know, the funny stuff. And, right. You know, he grew up around that. And that's why Barry Windham appreciated when he got put in and thrust into that spotlight because he had earned it and he worked for it. That's why I was always much more of a Barry Windham fan than I ever was a Lex Luger fan. But that being said, you're absolutely correct. That year from like the end of 88 into the early part of 1990, Lex Luger was really, really good. And he was in with really good wrestlers, but he absolutely held his own. And that night you talked about in Philadelphia, he was absolutely in the ring with Ricky Steamboat and held his own. 5-star match. I thought it was the best match of Lex Luger's career. Do you remember the other thing that happened that night in Philadelphia, John?
It happened right in front of me. If we're talking about the same thing, they had built up, obviously, the Jim Cornette versus Paulie Dangerously feud, and they were going to more or less blow it off at the Great American Bash. Well, the night before in Philly, they have, like, I want to say a 10-man tag or a 6-man tag, something, and Terry Gordy threw a chair in Jim Cornette's general direction, and Cornette, like, blew out his knee, or, like, right in front of me, and he's on the floor, you know, holding his knee in agony, going, "God damn fucking Terry Gordy, Jesus Christ." I felt bad for the guy. They planned on having like a 3- or 4-star match at the Bash. They had all the spots written out, and they're going to do this, do that. And Jim could barely walk the next day.
Yeah. And like you said, they had actually worked very diligently on planning a match that would not embarrass either one of them and was actually going to, in their mind, try to steal the show. And they went out and, God bless Jim. He must have either taken some pain pills or took a shot in the knee, and he went out and had a fairly decent match, but it wasn't anywhere to the level that they had hoped to have.
No, it wasn't. And that was what you were referring to, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Now, do you remember? Go ahead.
I was going to say, I remember going back into the dressing room with Dave Meltzer, and Jimmy was getting his knee taped up and cursing up a storm. And I remember Tommy Young going in there and kind of ribbing Jimmy about, you know, what happened? How'd you let this happen to yourself? And Jimmy kind of cut a promo on Tommy Young there in the dressing room, if I remember that.
How'd you let that happen to yourself? That's awesome. Now, what was the main event on that night?
Maybe Sting and Muda. Does that sound
Sting
about
and
right?
Funk.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Yeah, because they were saving Sting and Muda for the next night. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Now, what they were doing in theory or could have been smart, because Flair had been out with the injury. He was not coming back until the Great American Bash, which I think was July 23rd, 1989. So they're having they run a minor angle on TV with Terry Funk and Sting, and they go around the horn with them while Flair is out. And it would have made perfect sense if leading up to this big feud with Ric Flair, Terry Funk got some clean wins against Sting, but that's not what happened.
No, I mean, you know, God forbid you should take advantage of the guy being there. By the way, here's a question that I've asked on my show, John. Do you remember when Terry Funk debuted in WTBS studios? Because that was when they had gone to the new bigger studios. I forget what they call that place. Center Stage. I'm sorry. Thank you. Do you remember who his first opponent was?
I believe it was Eddie Guerrero.
You are absolutely correct. It was a young wrestler named Eddie Guerrero, who also featured a pretty sweet mullet. And Eddie went out there and made Terry look like absolutely $1 million. And but we could sit here and probably take 5 hours talking about all the stuff that WCW did. Yeah, as great a year as 1989 is remembered as because of the Flair Funk, the Flair Steamboat stuff, you know, the Sting Muda series. There are so many things that WCW screwed up from the corporate point of view and just going through bookers left and right and dumb decisions they made. You know, literally you could write a book. Just maybe that's my next book. I'll do a book on WCW 1989 and how they just completely screwed the pooch in so many ways.
WCW 1989, it's like a band that's been out putting out albums for 30 or 40 years. And then you get that one greatest hits CD with the 10 best songs on them. It's like the great stuff was great, but if you sit there and go through everything, there's a lot of head shaking going on.
Yeah, there were so, and I'm not even talking about the dumb stuff like, you know, the Ding Dongs and all that other stuff. I'm just talking about basic, you know, like the decision was made to bring back some guys that were well past their prime to try to take advantage of their name from when they were popular with the WWE guys like the JYD and the Iron Sheik, who were, and how about the Iron Sheik having his contract rolled over because some genius in Turner Broadcasting or WCW forgot to send him the notice that his contract was expiring. And because of that, the contract rolled over for another year. So they were paying the guy like 150 grand to basically sit at home and do nothing.
They did that constantly. That happened with, I know that happened with Tom Zank. I'm pretty sure it happened with Jimmy Garvin. I mean, to steal one from Jim Cornette, these guys' job at about $3,000 a week was to walk to the mailbox and grab the check.
Yeah. And it's nice work if you can get it, you know?
I mean, Larry Zbysko used to talk about how if you know, it was very important to get in that company, get in WCW, because it's a job for life. They'll always be paying you.
Yeah, because they, you know, it's amazing how the corporate suits just completely screwed the poot. And, you know, the amazing thing is Eric Bischoff, okay, who's, let's be honest, is an extremely polarizing figure. You know, you can sit there and talk about the things that he did well, you know, a few years after this in WCW. And there were things that the guy did well. But then, of course, he also did some things that weren't well. But comparatively speaking, Eric Bischoff, even in the worst times, looked like a complete genius compared to the guys. And I'm not just dumping on Jim Herd. There were other people that were really, you know, I mean, it wasn't Jim Herd's fault that the Iron Sheik had his contract rolled over. There were other people in that office that should have caught that this guy's contract was coming up. Oh, yeah. You know, geez, how did you guys end up making money if you're not looking at stupid stuff like that? And, you know, you're worried about your overhead. And here's something that is a contract you can just boom, 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 swipe right off your books. And somebody forgot to send the guy a letter, for God's sakes, alerting him that his contract was coming due and they were not going to be renewing it. And because they forgot to do that, roll over time. And it's another year collecting checks and going to the mailbox, like you said, John.
Well, the name of this podcast is Stick to Wrestling, but that's how the Boston Red Sox lost Carlton Fisk to free agency. They just didn't send him a renewal notice and contract voided. You're a free agent now.
Yeah. And, you know, and like I said, how do you not have someone who's just, you're in a corporation the size of Turner Broadcasting, you know, which of course WCW is a subsidiary of, how do you not have somebody whose job it is just to pay attention to that? You've got 50 wrestlers under some sort of contract, because by this point, most of the wrestlers were starting to get contracts because Vince had his guys under contract. How do you not have one person sitting in the office and sitting there going, oh yeah, Tommy Rich, that guy we're not using anymore, his contract's expiring in 30 days. We need to send him a letter. I mean,
we need to send him a certified letter.
Exactly.
Or we pay him $150,000 next year.
Exactly. That we have to explain to our shareholders why this guy is still getting paid 150 G's a year.
Another guy they brought in 1989. Well, first of all, there were guys that got offers that didn't get brought in. They wanted to bring in Big John Studd, which is how he wound up back in the WWF. They wanted to bring in Morocco, and for whatever reason, Morocco turned them down. They brought in a completely washed up Bob Orton Jr.
Well, they brought in lots of completely washed up people. I mean, that's like part of what they did. It seemed like, you know, and you know, the only guy that I can really remember that they brought in that they really did something with was Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman had started, you know, making a name for himself in Calgary. And I'm sure through some sort of recommendation by Dave, you know, because Dave was of course talking to people in that front office. Somebody got a tape of Brian Pillman, and all of a sudden we get word that Brian Pillman's going there, and Brian Pillman got himself over because he was a young, good-looking, you know, white meat baby face who had a look, had a you know, charisma to him, and he got himself over. And I you know, could never understand, you know, it wasn't like Brian Pillman was the only guy out there that you could take advantage of, as opposed to, you know, paying Bob Orton Jr. to come in and rehash what's been rehashed 1,000 times.
I'm with you there, you know, and stop and think about this. Brian Pillman gets that job. He gets in the car and he drives from Calgary to Atlanta.
Yeah, he wanted it. It meant something to him. It didn't mean anything to Bob Orton or Don Morocco at that time.
It was a
paycheck. Brian Pillman wanted to get himself over. He worked at getting himself over. And, you know, so yeah, there was, like I said, 1989 was all the good stuff that did happen. There's a lot of bad stuff that happened that year too.
Now, Pillman, from what I heard, you know, at the time, they had a TV match with him. He had a couple of TV matches at Center Stage, and they did not go well. And it looked like Pillman was, you know, going to get back in his car and drive back to Calgary. And for whatever reason, Ric Flair took a liking to him. And that's how he got to stay in the game.
Yeah, and I recall he had the famous match at Center Stage with Brian Pillman that really was what got Brian Pillman over with the folks in WCW and with the audience in WCW. I mean, I know he had the match at the Great American Bash. I want to say Bill Irwin. Was that who he fought?
I believe so. This is the 89 bash. Yeah, this is when he first got here, and I think it was Irwin.
But then he had the match, I want to say a month or two later, where he was on TBS, and he had started to get over it with the TBS crowd. But when he faced Flair, and Flair just gave him so much because Flair had taken an interest in, and you know, he said, "Hey, give me this kid. I can do some stuff with him." And that's when Brian Pillman really started taking off.
Yeah, I remember I went to the Halloween Havoc 89, which was their first not good pay-per-view in like five tries.
That was the plastic bag phenomenal, angle, right?
What's that?
That was the plastic bag angle with Terry Funk?
No, that was the Clash of the Champions from like September 1989 when Funk, like, his elbow was the size of his thigh because it was so blown up and he couldn't wrestle.
Oh, but Halloween Havoc was where they electrocuted Abby.
That was 91. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm getting my years mixed up. Okay. I'll try to keep the context straight here.
But yeah, they had Brian Pillman against Lex Luger, and you could kind of tell that they had planned on making this like the four-star match of the night, and it fell flat for a lot of reasons, but it just didn't make it to what they wanted it to be.
Yeah. But Pillman had tons of charisma, tons of potential. He really, you know, he was a really good babyface, but he really didn't come into his own until he turned heel. That's when you really, you know, it was probably, dare I say, probably more of a natural Brian Pillman. Brian Pillman was known as being a real smart ass, and his personality really could come to the forefront much more after he switched to the heel side.
That is everything that I've heard. Although I'll say one thing, I think you and I have always agreed on this. In order to get over, to really get over as a babyface, you've got to be a heel first. There are exceptions.
I think it makes it a lot easier, you know, because at least they've had a chance to see, you know, like Barry Windham. When Barry Windham was first the white meat baby face in Florida as a young kid who couldn't have been more than 20 years old. I'm talking about like 1979, 1980. Mm-hmm. He was a kid that, you know, kind of paid his dues on the CWF show. And then they worked the big angle where Don Morocco just completely destroyed him. But, you know, Barry kept fighting back and trying to get that, you know, that one little that shot in, and that one little shot would lead to him, you know, rolling up Morocco, getting a one count. Hey, I've talked about this before, John. I don't understand why promoters, whether it's, you know, ROH, whether it's the WWE, whether it's New Japan, why they don't look at the type of deal that they did with I'm going to use an example from that maybe folks will remember, like they did with Razor Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid. How much did the 1-2-3 Kid get over just by being in there and like kicking out of that pinfall from Razor Ramon before he even beat him, you know, as the young kid who's starting to make a name for himself, because now all of a sudden he's not as easy to, you know, put away as just a squash guy would be. And that template, that's the word I'm looking for. That template could be used for so many young guys. You put them in there with a veteran that sees something in the, you know, like the way Flair did with Pillman, and you make these young guys just by doing a program like that.
Yeah, and you would think, especially somewhere like WWE, you're not going to lose the guy. If you've got this 22, 23-year-old guy, and he's going to be a wrestler, and you start him at the bottom, but kind of build him up, I mean, they're not going to lose him to, you know, ROH or whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, you know, I can recall one of the reasons that I really hated WCW in the, you know, unlike a lot of people, I was not a huge fan of the whole Scott Hall and Kevin Nash and that whole thing in WCW. But I remember one time when like Rey Mysterio was in there, Rey Mysterio was getting over huge. And they did a deal where Rey Mysterio had been getting abused. And I think Kevin Hall threw him into the side of a truck or something like that. Just completely discarded him. And, you know, like just made him like where he was a piece of garbage after all that time they had spent getting Rey Mysterio over. And all I kept thinking was, you know, all Rey Mysterio had to do is get a two count on Kevin Nash. And that place would have popped like you'd never seen before. You know, that's all Kevin Nash had to do. He didn't have to lose to him. Just let the guy get a two count on you so that he's showing some sort of like ability instead of just making Kevin Nash this indestructible monster that no one could possibly beat unless apparently you used one finger like they did, you know. But that was part of the complaints I had with WCW there was they got these guys over, but these guys were not willing to give anybody a rub. And that's one reason why I hated WCW in that time period so much.
No, I mean, those guys were just, you know, I mean, uber selfish. I mean, what do I even say? And management allowed it. And that became, you know, like you said, the template. Just these guys are totally in it for themselves, collecting a paycheck. Jeff, you have been, you're like Kirk Gibson coming off the bench and hitting the home run.
I'm limping
in the World
up
Series.
To the plate.
Thank you so much. I cannot thank you enough for coming on today. Sean, we hope you get better very soon, and we are looking forward to having you back next week. Stick to Wrestling is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Go Vols. We'll see you next week.